Hosea 5:15. I will go and return to my place, till they acknowledge their offense, and seek my face. In their affliction they will seek me early. In the preceding part of the chapter, it threatened the destruction of Ephraim. Ephraim and the prophets generally means the 10 tribes or the kingdom of Israel as distinguished from the kingdom of Judah. When we read of Ephraim and Judah in the prophets, by this is meant the whole people of Israel, of the 12 tribes as in verse 12 of this chapter. Therefore will I be to Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness. By Judah is meant the 2 tribes of Judah and Benjamin, which were under the king of Judah, and by Ephraim is meant the 10 tribes under the king of Israel. Ephraim is put for the whole kingdom of Israel because Samaria, the seat of the kingdom, the royal city, was in that tribe. In the verse immediately preceding the text, it is declared in what a terrible manner God was about to deal with Ephraim. Hosea 5:14, for I will be to Ephraim as a lion, and as a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear and go away, and none shall rescue him. In the text, God declares how he would deal with him after he had torn as a lion. And here, first, God declares how he would withdraw from them, Hosea 5:15. I will go and return to my place. When I have torn as a lion, I will go away, I will leave them in that condition. I will depart from them, and they shall see no more of me. Number 2, what God will wait for in them before he returns to them to show them mercy. There are 3 things here signified. 1, that they should be sensible of their guilt, Hosea 5:15, till they acknowledge their offense. It is in the original, till they become guilty. That is, till they become guilty in their own eyes, till they are sensible of their guilt. In the same sense, it's the same expression as used in Romans 3:19, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world may become guilty before God. That is, become guilty in their own eyes. Number 2, that they would be sensible of their misery, implied in the expression of Hosea 5:15. In their affliction, they shall seek me. Their calamity was brought upon them before God had torn them and left them. But in their pride and perverseness, they were not sensible of their own miserable condition, as this prophet observes in chapter 7, verse 9. Number 3, that they should be sensible of their need of God's help, which is implied in their seeking God's face, and seeking him early, that is, with great care and earnestness. Before, they would not seek God. They were not sensible of their helplessness, as we learn in the verse, but one preceding the text, Hosea 5:13, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jacob. But as we are told there, he could not heal him, nor cure his wound. And notwithstanding all the help he could afford, God wounded him, tore him as a young lion, and, as he declares, would leave him. And he should cease going to any other, and should be sensible that no other could heal, and accordingly come to him for healing. Doctrine. That it is God's manner to make men sensible of their misery and unworthiness before he appears in his mercy and love to them. It is ordinarily thus with respect to the bestowment of great and signal mercies. Secondly, that it is particularly so with respect to revealing his love and mercy to their souls. This is God's ordinary way before great and signal expressions of his mercy and favor. He very commonly so orders it in his providence, and so influences men by his Spirit, that they are brought to see their miserable condition as they are in themselves, and to despair of help from themselves or from an arm of flesh, before he appears for them, and also makes them sensible of their sin and their unworthiness of God's help. This appears from the account which the scriptures give us of God's dealing with his people. Joseph, before his great advancement in Egypt, must lie in the dungeon to humble him and prepare him for such honor and prosperity. The children of Jacob, before Joseph reveals himself to them, and they receive that joy and honor and prosperity which were consequent thereupon, pass through a train of difficulties and anxieties, till at last they are reduced to distress, and are brought to reflect upon their guilt, and to say that they were verily guilty concerning their brother. God humbled them in his providence, and then an end was put to all their difficulties, and their sorrow was turned into joy, upon Joseph's revealing himself to them. Jacob, before he hears the joyful news of Joseph's being yet alive, must be brought into great distress at the parting with Benjamin and supposed loss of Simeon. He was reduced to great straits in his mind. He says in Genesis 42, verse 36, "All the things are against me." But soon after this, he had these gladsome tidings brought to him. Joseph is yet alive, and he is governor over all of the land of Egypt. And to confirm it, he sees the wagons and the noble presents which Joseph sent to him, so that he was now brought to say, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive." Genesis 45, verse 28. "I will go and see him before I die." And so with the children of Israel in Egypt, their bondage must wax more and more extreme. Their bondage had been very extreme, but yet Pharaoh gives commandment that more work should be laid upon them, and the taskmasters tell them that they must get their straw where they can find it, and nothing of their work should be diminished. And quickly upon this was their deliverance. So when the children of Israel were brought to the Red Sea, the Egyptians pursued them and were just at their heels, and they were reduced to the utmost distress. They see that they must assuredly perish unless God work a miracle for them, for they were shut up on all sides. The Red Sea was before them, and the army of the Egyptians encompassing them round behind. And they cried to the Lord, and then God wonderfully appeared for their help, and made them pass through the Red Sea, and put songs of deliverance into their mouths. So before God brought the children of Israel into Canaan, he led them about in a great and terrible wilderness through a train of difficulties and temptations for 40 years, that he might teach them in their dependence on him and the sinfulness of their own hearts. Deuteronomy 32, verse 10, "He found him in a desert land, and in the waste, howling wilderness. He led him about. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye." God brought them into those trials and difficulties in the wilderness to rebuke them and let them see what was in their hearts, that they might be convinced of their own perverseness by the many discoveries of it under those temptations, and so that they might be sensible that it was not for their righteousness that God made them his people and gave them Canaan, seeing it was so evident that they were a stiff-necked people. Deuteronomy 8, 2 and 3. "And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble you, and to prove you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you, and suffered you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you knew not, neither did the fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord does man live." In verses 15 to 17, "Who led you through that great and terrible wilderness, in which were fiery serpents and scorpions, and drought, where there was no water, who brought you forth out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, and that he might prove you, to do you good at the latter end. And you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth." And so we have examples of this from time to time in the history of the judges. When Israel revolted, God gave them into the hands of their enemies. He let them continue in their hands till they were reduced to great distress, and saw that they were in a helpless condition, and were brought to reflect on themselves and cry to the Lord. And then God raised them up, a deliverer. And when they cried to God, he would not deliver them till he had humbled them and brought them to their own unworthiness, and to own that they were in God's hands, beginning with the 10th verse of Judges 10. "And the children of Israel cried to the Lord, saying, we have sinned against you, because we have forsaken our God, and also served Baal. And the Lord said to the children of Israel, Did not I deliver you from the Egyptians, and from the Amorites, and from the children of Ammon, and from the Philistines? The Zidonians also, and the Amalekites, and the Maonites did oppress you, and you cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand. Yet you have forsaken me, and served other gods, in which I will deliver you no more. Go and cry to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation. And the children of Israel said to the Lord, We have sinned. Do thou unto us whatsoever seems good to you. Deliver us only, we pray you, this day. And they put away the strange gods from among them, and served the Lord, and his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel. And this is the method in which God declared from the beginning he would proceed with his people. If they shall confess their iniquity, and the iniquity of their fathers, with their trespass, which they trespassed against me, and that also they have walked contrary to me, and that I also have walked contrary to them, and have brought them into the land of their enemies, if then their uncircumcised hearts be humbled, and then they accept of the punishment of their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham will I remember, and I will remember the land. The land also shall be left of them, and shall enjoy her Sabbath, while she lies desolate without them. And they shall accept of the punishment of their iniquity, because even because they despise my judgments, and because her soul abhorred my statutes. And yet for all that, when they be in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, neither will I abhor them to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will for their sakes remember the covenant of their ancestors, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt, in the sight of the heathen, that I might be their God. It is God's manner when he will bestow signal blessings and answer to prayer, to make men seek them and pray for them with a sense of their sin and misery. As 1 Kings 8:38-39, what prayer and supplication soever be made by any man, or by all your people Israel, which shall know every man the plague of his own heart, and spread forth his hands toward this house, then hear you in heaven, your dwelling place, and forgive and do and give to every man according to his ways, whose heart you know. For you, even you only, know the hearts of all the children of men, by knowing the plague of their own hearts as men both their sin and misery. Being sensible of their misery is included, as is evident from the manner of expressing the same petition of Solomon's prayer, as it is related in 2 Chronicles 6:29. Then what prayer or supplication soever shall be made of any man, or of all your people Israel, when every man shall know his own sore and his own grief, by which is probably meant his misery and his sin, which is the foundation of it. Paul gives us an account how God brought him to have despair in himself before a great deliverance which he experienced in 2 Corinthians 1:9-10. But we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God, which raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death. How did Christ humble the woman with Canaan, or bring her to the exercise and expression of a sense of their own unworthiness before he answered her and healed her daughter? When she continued to cry, after he answered her not a word, and seemed to take no notice of her, and his disciples desired him to send her away, and when she continued crying after him, he gave a very humble answer, saying, It is not fit to take the children's bread and to cast it to dogs. And when she took it well, as owning that being called a dog was not too bad, and owning that she was therefore unworthy of children's bread, she only sought the crumbs. Then Christ answered her request. And the experience of God's people in all ages corresponds with those examples. It is God's usual method, before remarkable discoveries of his mercy and love to them, especially by spiritual mercies, and in a special manner to humble them, and make them sensible of their misery and helplessness in themselves, and of their vileness and unworthiness, either by some remarkably humbling dispensation of his providence, or influence of his Spirit. We come now, secondly, to show particularly that it is God's manner to make men sensible of their misery and unworthiness before he reveals his saving love and mercy to their souls. The mercy of God, which he shows to a sinner when he brings him home to the Lord Jesus Christ, is the greatest and most wonderful exhibition of mercy and love of which men are ever the subjects. There are other things in which God greatly expresses his mercy and goodness to men. Many temporal favors, the mercies already mentioned, which God bestowed upon his people of old, his advancing Joseph in Egypt, his deliverance of the children of Israel out of Egypt, his leading them through the Red Sea on dry land, his bringing them into Canaan and driving out the heathen from before them, his delivering them from time to time from the hands of their enemies were great mercies. But they were not equal to this of his people from under the guilt and dominion of sin. Several of them were typical of this, and as God would thus prepare men for the bestowment of those less mercies by making them sensible of their guilt and misery, so especially will he so do before he makes known to them this great love of his in Jesus Christ. When God designs to show mercy to sinners, it is his manner thus to begin with them. He first brings them to reflect upon themselves and consider and be sensible what they are and what condition they are in. What has already been said proves this. There is a harmony between God's dispensations, and as we see that this is God's manner of dealing with men when he gives them other great and remarkable mercies and manifestations of his favor, it is a confirmation that it is his method of proceeding with the souls of men when about to reveal his mercy and love to them in Jesus Christ. God makes men consider and be sensible of what sin they are guilty of. Before, it may be, they were very regardless of this. They went on sinning and never reflected upon what they did. They never considered or regarded what or how many sins they committed. They saw no cause why they should trouble their minds about it. But when God convinces them, he brings them to reflect upon themselves. He sets their sins in order before their eyes. He brings their old sins to their minds so that they are fresh in their memory, things which they had almost forgotten. And many things which they used to regard as light offenses, which were not wont to be a burden to their consciences, nor to appear worthy to be taken notice of, they are now made to reflect upon. Thus they discover of what a multitude of transgressions they have been guilty, which they have heaped up till they are grown up to heaven. There are some sins especially of which they have been guilty, which are ever before them, so that they cannot get them out of their minds. Sometimes when men are under conviction, their sins follow them and haunt them like a specter. God makes them sensible of the sins of their hearts, how corrupt and depraved their hearts are. And there are two ways in which he does this. One is by setting before them the sins of their lives. They are so set in order before them, they appear so many and so aggravated that they are convinced what a fountain of corruption there is in their hearts. Their sinful natures appear by their sinful lives. There is sin enough which every man has committed to convince him that he is sold under sin, that his heart is full of nothing but corruption, if God by his Spirit leads him rightly to consider it. Another way which God sometimes makes use of is to leave men to such internal workings of corruption under the temptations which they have in their terrors and fears of hell. It shows them what a corrupt and wicked heart they have. God sometimes brings this good out of this evil to make men see the corruption of their nature by the workings of it under temptations which they have in their terrors about damnation. God leads them through the wilderness to prove them and let them know what is in their hearts as he did the children of Israel, as we have already observed. By means of the trials which the children of Israel had in the wilderness, they might be made sensible what a murmuring, perverse, rebellious, unfaithful, and idolatrous people they were. So God sometimes makes sinners sensible what wicked hearts they have by their experience of the exercises of corruption while they are under convictions. Not that this will in the least excuse men for allowing such workings of corruptions in their hearts, because God sometimes leaves men to be wicked that he may afterward turn it to their good, when he in infinite wisdom sees fit to do so. We must not go and be wicked on purpose, that we may get good by it. That would be very absurd as well, as horribly presumptuous for us to do so. Though God sometimes in his sovereign mercy makes those workings of corruption, in a spirit of opposition and enmity against God, a means of showing them the vileness of their own hearts, and so to turn to their good. So God oftentimes is provoked by this utterly to withdraw and forsake them, after the example of those murmurers whose carcasses fell in the wilderness, of whom God swore in his wrath that they should never enter into his rest. And they who allow themselves therein are the most likely so to provoke God. But it is God's manner to show men the plague of their own hearts, by some means or other, before he reveals his redeeming love to their souls. While sinners are unconvinced, sin lies hidden. They don't take any notice of it. But God makes a law effectual to bring men's own sins of heart and life to be reflected on and observed. Romans 7 verse 9. I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived. Then sin appeared and came to light, which was not before observed. Joseph's revealing himself to his brethren is probably typical of Christ's revealing himself to the soul of a sinner, making known himself in his love and in his near relation of a brother and a redeemer of his soul. But before Joseph revealed himself to them, they were made to reflect upon themselves and say, Genesis 42, verse 21, we are verily guilty. Number 2, God convinces sinners of the dreadful danger they are in by reason of their sin. Having their sin set before them, God makes them sensible of the relation which their sin has to misery. And here are two things of which they are convinced about their danger. God makes them sensible that his displeasure is very dreadful. Before, they heard often about the anger of God and the fierceness of his wrath, but they were not moved by it. But now they are made sensible that it is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. They are made in some measure sensible of the dreadfulness of hell. They are led with fixedness and impression to think what a dismal thing it will be to have God, an enraged enemy, setting to work the misery of a soul, and how dismal it will be to dwell in such torment forever without hope. Isaiah 33, verse 14. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with a devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? Other sinners are told of hell, but convinced sinners often have hell, as it were, in their view, they being impressed with a sense of the dreadfulness of its misery is the cause why it works upon their imagination oftentimes. And it will seem as though they saw the dismal flames of hell, as though they saw God in implacable wrath, exerting his fury upon them, as though they heard the cries and shrieks of the damned. Number 2, they are made in some measure sensible of the connection there is between their sins and that wrath, or how their sin and guilt exposes them to that wrath, of the dreadfulness of which they have such lively apprehensions, and so fear takes hold of them. They are afraid that will be their portion, and they are sensible that they are in a miserable and doleful condition by reason of sin. Many things in the scripture makes it evident that this is God's method. The account we have of our first parents confirms it. They had a sense of guilt and danger before Christ was revealed to them. They were guilty and were afraid of God's wrath and ran and hid themselves. They were terribly afraid when they heard God coming, and doubtless their sense of their guilt and fear when they were brought before God and were called to an account, and God asked them what they had done, and whether they had eaten of that tree in which he commanded them that they should not eat, prepared them for a discovery of mercy. God made them sensible of their guilt and danger before he revealed to them the covenant of grace. And it is probable that their reflecting upon what God said about the seed of the woman bruising the serpent's head soon wrought faith, that it was not long before that discovery God made of a merciful design towards them was a means of true consolation and hope to them. Joseph's brethren were brought into great distress for fear of their lives before Joseph revealed himself to them. Those who were converted by Peter's sermon were first pricked in their hearts in a sense of their guilt in their danger. Acts 2, verse 37. And Paul, before he had had his first comfort, trembled and was astonished. Acts 9, verse 6. And continued 3 days and three nights, and neither ate nor drank, which expressed his great distress. The jailer, before he was converted, was in terror. He called for a light and sprang in and came trembling and fell down before Paul and Silas. Acts 16, verses 29 and 30. Christ's invitation is made more especially to the weary and heavy laden, which doubtless has respect at least partly to laboring and being weary with a sense of guilt and danger. We read, when David was in the cave of Adullam, then everyone who was in distress was gathered to him, 1 Samuel 22, verse 1. This doubtless was written as typifying Jesus Christ, and referring to those who were in fear and distress to him, the expression of flying for refuge, by which coming to Christ is signified, implies that before they come, they are in fear of some evil. They apprehend themselves in danger, and as fear gives wings to their feet, Proverbs 18:10. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The voice of God to a sinner when he gives him true comfort is a still small voice. But this voice is preceded by a strong wind and a terrible earthquake, and fire as it was in Horeb when Elijah was there. 1 Kings 19, 11 and 12. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. Another thing in the scriptures which seems to evince this is a frequent comparison made between the church spiritually bringing forth Christ and a woman in travail and pain to be delivered. John 16, verse 21, and Revelation 12, verse 2. The conversion of a sinner is represented by the same thing. It is bringing forth Christ in the heart. Paul speaks of men's regeneration as of Christ being brought forth in them, Galatians 4, verse 19, and therefore Christ calls believers his mother, Matthew 12, 49 and 50. And he stretched forth his hand toward his disciples and said, Behold my mother and my brethren, for whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother. Hosea 5, 15, I will go and return to my place, till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me early,